Donald Kagan, who is the Sterling Professor of Classics and History at Yale University, is the author of many important works. He was last year in studio when we discussed his utterly significant book on the origins of war and the preservation of peace. More recently, he's been with us often on the phone as we have been reacting to, initially, the attack on September 11th, and I think you were with us that very night or the next night.
Pretty soon, yeah.
And often thereafter as we examine the prospects for war in Iraq and related matters. But tonight we're looking at a very old war.
Indeed, the Peloponnesian War happened something like 2,400 years ago.
I thought of Neville Chamberlain. You remember this famous kind of silly quote from him. During the first phase of the Sudeten crisis, when he says, isn't it monstrous that we should be considering, or we should be endangered now by a struggle in a distant land between peoples of whom we know nothing?
That's right.
And I ask you, just giving you a setup, so you could respond and take us directly to it and point up how important the Peloponnesian War is for us. Isn't it strange that we are looking now at a war between two leagues of city-states led by Athens and Sparta, respectively, in the last third of the 5th century B.C. Isn't that a struggle, not only distant in space, but also in time, between two peoples of whom we know comparatively nothing?
Yes, well, I should point out that I was so struck by that because Thucydides begins his narrative of that war in a way that makes me quote that very Chamberlain statement about where that war broke out. It broke out in a distant region in the
northwest. Sudeten land of Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, and the truth is, when Thucydides begins his account, he says Epidamnus, which is where the thing starts, is a town on the right as you sail up the Ionian Sea. He had to tell that to his fellow Greek students. Mm-hmm. They didn't know where the hell it was. It was like the Sarajevo of 1914, and as you say. So, but the question of why we might be interested in reading about this war between two great coalitions of Greek states 2,400 years ago. And it bears very much on the question of why anybody cares about the Peloponnesian War. One reason, of course, was that it was an enormous turning point in the history of the Greek world, which has played such a large part in shaping civilization ever since. But I think another very large reason is that what makes that war so meaningful to us is that a man wrote the history of that war, an Athenian by the name of Thucydides, who was a general in Athens at the time, and he had such a profound understanding of the relevance and significance of history, and of based upon his assumption that there were certain things about human beings in a society that were permanent, so that he brought out those aspects of the war he described, which he thought had permanent relevance, and he's convinced most people who've read the book ever since.
He's got a passage in the first chapter in which he talks about his methodology, and it's a modern methodology.
Isn't it?
He says, for any event, I need three separate sources, and where there are discrepancies, I need to reconcile them and have to get into the field and maybe get some people to do some legwork for me and so on. Then he ends that passage with this famous quotation, my history has been composed to be an everlasting possession, not the showpiece of an hour.
Yes, and it's worked for him. People, I've been struck. I've been studying Thucydides now very seriously for probably over 50 years.
I should note that you did a major four volume treatment of the Peloponnesian War done at the scholarly level. Your new book covers the same material, though it isn't just drawn from those early works. It's not a synthesis an abridged version. It is rather newly written, but it is titled The Peloponnesian War.
Yes. Well,
and you've been working on it for some 35 years, as you said.
As I say, what makes it so inescapable is that this guy was maybe the second historian of significance in the history of the world, Herodotus being the first.
And Herodotus didn't triangulate and have three different sources.
No, he had a different approach thoroughly. But Thucydides, as you rightly say, has sort of the modern way of thinking about it, of serious critical history, and the purpose is what's important. Herodotus tells us, why is he writing his book? He tells us, so that the great deeds of men shall not be forgotten. So it's a kind of a memorial to a wonderful thing.
But when Thucydides says, my history has been composed to be an everlasting possession, what he means is it will have meaning for future time and will be, in some sense, a guide.
Exactly right. He is convinced that because of the consistencies in human behavior, and a very intelligent man who studies very, very hard and who has good intuition, notice how few people are left when we've said that, will be able to use his work as a guide to making judgments in the world in which they live.
Another interesting quotation, Dionysius of Halicarnassus quotes Tacitus as having said, history is philosophy teaching by examples.
Yes, and you could say that about Thucydides, but it would be too simple. Tacitus's way of looking at it, I think, was rather Roman. The Romans really did have the sense you could tell this story and the guys would look at the piece that they wanted and they would take that piece and use it. Thucydides was much more subtle and complicated than that. He knew it would take a very fine mind to see what there was to see and it was a combination of capacity and study.
There is a central assertion in his work which you draw upon very heavily. In fact, Freud could have written to Thucydides. Remember, who was it? Who writes? It was Einstein who wrote to Freud, saying, after World War I, saying, "I don't understand war. It's such a terrible burden for mankind. You, Dr. Freud, are the great explorer of the human soul and of the recesses of the mind. Why war?" And that correspondence was published under Why War?
Yes.
Well, Thucydides asked the same question much earlier, and he's got a three-part answer.
Oh, yes. Well, that has proven to me to be one of the most illuminating things to be found in Thucydides. He has an Athenian speaker in Sparta, I think he was reporting what the guy said, twice used this triad of motives of why people go to war, and he has them in two different sets of orders. One is fear, honor, and interest. And then the other time he has them say, honor, fear, and interest. And I think you will rarely find a war of any consequence in which those things are not at play.
Fear, honor, and interest.
Yes.
What is that in ancient Greek?
Ah, let's see. Fear is deos, time, and ophelia. Ophelia can be translated as advantage also.
A Greek scholar of my acquaintance, when I asked him that, said, used tau sumpheron. What is that?
Oh, well, he doesn't use those words, but that means the advantageous.
Yeah.
But Thucydides doesn't use that term. He actually uses ophelia.
Fear is essentially is fear that somebody's gaining on you, that somebody is threatening you, that unless you meet his power and his malign intent with an equally aggressive response, you might be swamped and the whole city-state or the whole polis might be destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the wonderful thing is that there's a whole range of fear causing events, and different people can operate at different levels of sophistication. Guy comes at you with a club, you feel fear, and one of the possible reactions is to get your own club, and that's there too. But Thucydides, when he's talking about fairly sophisticated states, which are Athens and Sparta are, and leaders of coalitions, empires, they do what we do. They think ahead. And they say, how will this action create an impact on what will happen in the future? Maybe today that's okay. But if we don't do something about that, down the road we'll be in trouble, and that can lead them.
That's what modern strategic theorists call worst-case analysis.
Worst-case analysis. And but it's just, it can be simply analysis. Sometimes they will conclude, that's not a big deal, we don't have to worry about it. But sometimes they will say, that's a real fear, a legitimate fear, we got to do something about it.
So that's fear.
Yes.
The other part of the triad is interest, meaning...
Well, interest is what most people in the 21st century think people go to war about, and they're wrong. To gain some material end is what they usually have.
Like oil from Iraq.
Like oil from Iraq. The people that talk about going to war. Yes, it's about oil in Iraq, but it's not about our getting the oil or having it cheaper or making a lot of money selling it. It's about preventing a dangerous character from using his control of oil for strategic purposes that will have devastating political results.
So, in fact, it's fear still.
It's a form of fear, but the one that gets the least appreciation in the 20th century, and my studies convince me, is the most frequently present and the most frequently important, is honor. It's a word we don't even use, and people don't know what you mean by that. But in international relations, it means things like respect. It means things like prestige. It has to do with a sense. It's really best thought of, I think, in the negative. You don't want somebody to be able to treat you with contempt, to dishonor you.
Here's one instance of the application of that concern by a president of the United States and the people around him. Lyndon Johnson keeps us in the Vietnam War, basically because maybe the dominoes will fall, but really they will fall only because we will lose that degree of respect around the world that is accorded to us as a major power, and that will then put us in a much weaker position in the face of future challenges.
Oh, absolutely. Every president who dealt with Vietnam had to confront this problem. If we retreat from Vietnam, we may be perceived as lacking the qualities necessary to sustain ourselves against the Soviet Union, and we may be lost in that struggle. That consideration was always present.
So was that, in fact, a good and justified reason to stay in Vietnam?
It's a very hard question, because one of the issues that you always have to do is to ask yourself, what's the trade-off between doing something and not doing something? And I think it's a hard call. You know, what's interesting to me about my reaction towards Vietnam, it's a little bit the opposite of the general view. People generally say that was a bad war, an evil war. We were on the wrong side. It was a dishonorable thing to do. Da 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 da. That's nonsense. That was one of the easiest calls in the world from the standpoint of acting according to American principles. Here were people who were suffering aggression, trying to establish their own regime free of the communist regime in the North, which God knows now, who could doubt, was one of the most wicked and criminal regimes anybody ever saw. And we were trying to allow them to establish their self-determination. Morally, it was perfectly reasonable war. Now, if you raise the question, was it a sensible war from a strategic point of view, that's very, very open to question. It's not just that we did badly in it. I think it was always open to question. It's worth remembering, for instance, Milt, I know you do, but hardly anybody else does. Our concern, at least publicly stated, and maybe even meant, was not that the Russians would gain, but that the Chinese would gain. And if you look back, so who would care at this point if the Chinese had managed to gain control of Vietnam? How serious a blow if they were separate from the Soviet Union? So I think there were a lot of real problems of analysis.
Something else happened. I wonder whether Thucydides touches on this as an aspect of the waging of war and the undermining of the will towards war. Something happened during the Vietnam War, namely a big basic sea change in American public opinion.
Yes.
The American public, which may have accepted that war in the beginning, grew very, very war fatigued and ultimately very distrustful,
yes,
of that war, so that the credibility of our keeping our force going,
yes,
was diminished, because the other side could think, since those people don't favor it, sooner or later the elite is going to have to pull the troops out.
And that's certainly what Ho Chi Minh counted on,
yeah,
and it certainly did have some effect. Although I mean, it's not really our topic, but I always want to get this straight if I possibly can. The track record is clear. The American people supported the war against Vietnam until the moment when they were convinced we were not trying to win.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same in Korea. So that Americans have very rarely turned against a war, even when it was very difficult and there were a lot of casualties. But they do to turn. They're not prepared to do it to get a draw.
I've drawn you into the modern time. We haven't yet talked much about the Iraq War, which has just been waged and won, but we will certainly. But some commercials coming, then we should go back to the Peloponnesus, back to the great struggle, and examine. I'm interested in your conclusion, and I guess it's also implicit or explicit in Thucydides, that in a way that war was a war that did not absolutely have to be fought. It starts in a way almost inadvertently, or by virtue of inattention rather than by...
Actually, you've been reading me rather than Thucydides.
More than Thucydides,
because
yeah.
I contest Thucydides. He holds a different view. He thinks it was a war that was inevitable.
All right, let's examine the quarrel between you and Thucydides right after we pause for these words. Our very special guest for the evening is Donald Kagan, professor of classics and history at Yale University, author a few years ago of a very important book on the origins of war and the preservation of peace, many other studies essentially in classical historiography, a great biography of Pericles, which is pretty close to Pericles, of course, is the war leader,
right,
not in the field, but he is essentially the main man in Athens at the time that the war begins. But why does that war begin?
Well, Thucydides explains it in a pretty neat way after explaining, giving you a lot of information about it. He says something like, the reason that was most the truest cause is what he says, but the one most hidden from view, the one that people didn't know about, was not these detailed quarrels that were the ostensible cause of the war, but the growing power of Athens and the fear that it engendered among the Spartans. Now, then he goes on to explain what does he mean by that, and there's this sketch of the 50 years history between the end of the Persian War and the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War, a sketch which shows a new power emerging on the international scene, Athens as a great power and then as the head of a great naval empire, challenging the previous unquestioned predominance of the Spartan League, and as his interpretation would show it, inevitably creating a sense of unease among the Spartans. They said, we've got to do something about this before these guys come after us. And my own studies have persuaded me that that isn't quite right, that it might be a fair explanation of why the Athenians fought the Spartans beginning around 460 in what we modern scholars call the First Peloponnesian War. But that came to a negotiated end in 445. And my view is that there was no necessity for a war coming after that. No guarantee that it wouldn't, but no necessity. But events that were not planned by either side, and this is where your reading of it is very legitimate, then took such a shape that while neither side really wanted to go to war at that point, both found it necessary to take a course that did compel it.
But it starts with a war that doesn't involve either of them.
That's
it starts
right.
with a military action on the part of two lesser states.
Absolutely. There's it's even more than that. It starts with a civil war in a tiny remote town that nobody knew where it was. But because of what happens, I mean, it was studying the Peloponnesian War was particularly revealing in the years of the Cold War, because it was an example of what happens when you have a world divided into two great power blocks, so that every little quarrel that involves anybody can quickly become an issue if it involves anybody who's related to the two great powers. That's what happened in the Peloponnesian War. Corinth, doing some adventuring of its own in an area where they didn't have to do anything, it wasn't vital, but they wanted to, their honor was involved, and they started a quarrel. The state with whom they quarreled now found itself in the position that so many states were in the Peloponnesian War. I mean to say in the Cold War. They could go to one side or the other and say, how about coming along with us? And they went to Athens, and because this was a state that had such a large navy, that the switch, if not to Athens, but to the other side, had taken place, it would have destroyed the Athenian confidence that they could control the seas, which was necessary for Athenian safety. So the Athenians took them into the alliance, and now the pot was boiling.
One theme we've got in mind in recent years, in part because of a book, an important book that's been done on it, is the clash of civilizations.
Yes.
Is there anything about the considerable difference between the way the Athenians lived and the way they valued and the way they worshipped and so on, and the way the Spartans did? Is there something about the fact that each was rather alien to the other, though they were in contact, that also accounts for the war?
Something, but I would say very little. I think the issues were really much more issues of power politics and of fear and honor. The differences were real, but they were all Greeks, and they all were Greeks of the polis, of the city-state. And the similarities, I think, were more important than the differences. I think one can overemphasize that aspect.
That war is characterized by lots of people who look back on it, and they look through the lens provided by Thucydides, also by Xenophon to some degree, and Plutarch writes about these people about four centuries later.
Yeah.
And writes about some of the major figures, but thus goes through some of the available history. And they must be worked from some sources that we no longer have available.
Exactly.
As well.
Exactly, yes.
But the overall characterization is that was an awfully bloody, brutal war. It got worse and worse. It regressed more and more, and it wound up with genocidal activity.
Yes.
And it was really quite dreadful.
It really was, and it was, in some ways, it has been compared, and it's with value, it's been compared to World War I. I mean, here's the way the comparison works. I think there's something to it. Most people would suggest that if you look at the Western world, and particularly Europe, in the 19th century and right on after the Napoleonic century, between the Napoleonic Wars and the First World War, it's a rather optimistic period. It's a great cultural period. It's a period of stunning economic growth. It's a period of growing democracy for the first time in European history. It's a period of a sense of progress, a sense that things are getting better and will get better in every sense. And I think it was true. And this war came along, and nobody expected it to be what it was. Everybody expected it to be a short thing. First of all, very long by the standards of the 19th
century. It's a 30-year war, essentially.
Well, but thinking only of the 4 years of the 1914 to 1918, even that is long given what had been going on in the 19th century. But also brutal and destructive to a degree not heard of. In a way, the last time you could think of such a thing would be the 30 Years' War in Germany. Mm-hmm. But certainly nothing in between. Even the wars of Napoleon and the French Revolution couldn't match what was going on.
But for World War I, you could argue, well, they had new instrumentation. They had new weapons, which were extremely deadly. That's you can't argue that for the Greeks.
What I want to say is, first of all, the same thing can be said about the 50 years before the Peloponnesian War about Greece. This is the great period. Mm-hmm. This is when everything's accomplished that will make us care about these guys. So that's similar. Democracy is also growing for the first time in the history of the world. All of that's happening. What happens that's different in the Peloponnesian War is, as you rightly say, it's not so much a technological weapons thing, although in one way it was. There was one potent, new, incredible weapon of mass destruction, you might call it, the Athenian fleet. Now, there had been ships like these ships before, but nobody had ever created a naval force with the incredible power that the Athenians were able to do in this stretch. And that's one of the things that terrified the Spartans. They had no answer for that sort of thing. So I would say that made it possible to have a kind of war the Greeks never saw before. Up to this point, essentially every war was a land war between two armies of heavy infantrymen. And it usually lasted a matter of hours. And the war was over. Now, the Peloponnesian War, the Athenians, because of their new technology, you might say, and the new kind of society they had, they could allow the Spartans to do what they could never have allowed anybody else to do. No Greeks could ever allow any other. They could come into Attica. They could destroy the crops. The Athenians could hide behind their walls, and their ships, which dominated the sea in their empire, could keep them going forever. That meant the war could go on. People could do things now that they couldn't do before, and they couldn't just end it with one battle.
Didn't they learn the force of naval power about 50 years earlier at the Battle of Salamis, which ends the Persian War?
They didn't learn it, and they were right not to learn it, because at that point, no Greek state had a navy that could dominate other Greek states.
Mm-hmm.
They could beat the Persians, but nobody, the Athenians didn't have a fleet of that kind anymore, as yet. But they did by the time the Peloponnesian War comes about, and they had no wall. That's another thing. Yeah, Athens did not have walls connecting it to the sea in 479. So there's another piece of technology, a kind of a, you know what it is, like an anti-missile defense that works.
How does the war play out? What are the major phases?
There's a 10-year stretch that from the start to what we call the Peace of Nicias that is pretty much, but not perfectly, fought along the lines that Pericles and company had in mind at the beginning of the war. And the Athenians had no way to win such a war. When that plan began to fail, different men after the death of Pericles instituted a more aggressive policy. It paid off for a while and got the Spartans so upset that they were prepared to make peace. The Athenians didn't accept the peace. Then they suffered reverses when they were trying to be too daring. And so pretty soon the two sides wore each other out and made a peace. Neither side had been convinced, though. So it was really, we know, it was a truce. Shall I go on with periods, or do you want to interrupt with another?
Well, I was just going to say, Nicias, significant historical figures also have to be accounted for.
Absolutely.
Pericles was a great leader and a very significant figure, but he dies even before that 10-year period is over, as I remember it.
That's right.
Nicias is a man also of considerable probity, decency,
yes,
and high respect from the Athenians.
Oh, yes.
And he's the one who forges this peace, isn't he?
He's the man who makes this peace, and from that time forward, he does everything he can to avoid a resumption of the war. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that stretch of time is the second phase of the war, the period of the Peace of Nicias, which is no peace, as Thucydides tells us.
Only runs for about 3 years, doesn't
it? No, it actually runs longer, from 421 down to 415, so that's 6 years.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they're fighting all through it in different ways, because it's a phony peace. It didn't matter. I mean, neither side really meant it. But Nicias tries his best to make it work, but it's hopeless. And then the odd thing is that when the Athenians then decide to invade Sicily, something that's completely at odds with Pericles' advice and doesn't have an immediate really impressive strategic value, but it turns out to be a major disaster.
That's a great disaster. You compare it, I think, going back to World War I, to the Dardanelles.
Yes.
Or even worse, I would say.
To Vietnam, too.
To Vietnam.
Yes.
There's a wonderful passage from Thucydides that one might read, his summary, his last paragraph or so, in the chapter on the Syracusan campaign. Or rather, the Sicilian campaign. And we'll go to that right after we pause for this. And we return to Donald Kagan, drawing from his masterly volume, The Peloponnesian War. I should have said that that is just published by Viking. And we are... The Sicilian campaign has its ups and downs, and we can't go through all of that, but they come a cropper. They come badly a cropper. The Persians have returned to the scene, joining the Spartans.
Yes.
In trying to humiliate and defeat the Athenians.
Yes. Yeah, the Persians have been sort of suffering those wounds when they were defeated by the Greeks, and the Athenians are now occupying areas of what that used to be part of the Persian Empire, and they've never given up over getting it back. The Athenian disaster in Sicily leaves them so weak that everybody thinks they're finished. It really, the general idea is the war's going to be over in no time at all. The Persian king says, I want to get in on that. And so he now makes an alliance with the Spartans, and suddenly that changes the entire strategic situation, because now Persia will have a navy, and that navy will be paid for by the great king. And although the Athenians are still better, and they sink Sparta's fleet one after another, the Persians keep buying them new ones. And that ultimately is what will bring Athens down.
There's a last paragraph in Thucydides as he ends his account of the Sicilian campaign. Do read it.
Yes. This was the greatest event in the war, or, in my opinion, in Greek history. At once most glorious to the victors and most calamitous to the conquered. They were beaten at all points and all together. Their sufferings were great. They were totally destroyed, their fleet and their army, everything. And few out of many returned home. So ended the Sicilian expedition. That's powerful stuff.
It is very powerful. But that doesn't fully end the war. The war ends shortly thereafter.
Not so short.
A few years yet.
The disaster takes place in 413. The Athenians hold out almost a whole decade after that. And Thucydides, in one of his summing up passages, remarks on the amazing fact that they could do so even after the Sicilian. And in fact, it's worth remembering, you see, Thucydides breaks off in 411, just 2 years after this. The war rolls on for 7 years afterwards, so most people don't read Xenophon, and they don't know what happened. Twice in those last 7 years, the Athenians defeat the Spartans so severely at sea that the Spartans make a peace offer.
As far as we know, by scholarly reconstruction, Thucydides is born in 460, is that right?
Roughly, people guess.
B.C. That's
yeah.
And dies in 400 B.C.
Roughly.
So he's died, whereas the peace, the final end of the war, comes in
404.
So he's lived through that, but his account doesn't take us to the end.
No.
Why not?
Nobody knows, but I think the best guess is the simplest, that he was working away at it with the great effort that it required, and he just got as far as he got. He quit in the middle of a sentence, you know. He doesn't actually complete the last sentence, although that's usually covered up in the English translation. So... I have the picture of a guy burning the midnight oil for the next chapter or finishing the one he's on and expiring.
I'm suddenly thinking of, what's his name, the New York author who's doing the multi-volume political biography of Lyndon Johnson.
Caro.
Bob Caro.
Yes.
And he intended it to be, I think, two volumes. He's now done...
That's right.
...four, and he's got two or three more to go. And you kind of wonder, will he make it?
Caro will make it. I'm certain that he'll make it. He will. He's determined to get Johnson to the last second.
Yeah,
he won't die until he gets it.
His health has to hold up.
No, his health will hold out until he gets Johnson. But you know, it's fascinating. Nobody ever thinks of Thucydides' work this way, but it's a noble fragment.
Mm-hmm.
You think of it as a complete thing, but it isn't.
The book has had tremendous influence down through the years, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
One thinks of a great political theorist much interested in the question of war and the nature of mankind and the nature of states, namely Thomas Hobbes,
yes,
writing in the 17th century. And essentially, He's picking up from Thucydides, isn't
Absolutely.
he?
Absolutely. He's very blatant about, you know, saying Thucydides is his author, his
He even
source.
Does a translation of Thucydides.
And he makes a translation of Thucydides, but it is his view of what I would call the pre-civilized state of mankind. It's straight out of Thucydides' account of it, particularly in two places. In the Great Plague in Athens in 430, where the veneer of civilization is stripped away by the fear of death, and then his description of the civil war in Corcyra, where, again, the fear of everything coming apart reduces human beings to the most elemental stage, which is brutal and savage.
We come to a crucial question, and you've taken a position on this. Lots of people would want to argue with you about this because they want to be a little bit more hopeful about the human condition.
Yes.
And that's the question of whether war is with us eternally, because it's built into not merely our nature as human being, as human individuals, but it's built into the nature of the collectivities by which we live,
yeah.
Whether they're states or city-states or
yes.
what have you. And you essentially say that the normal condition of man, of human society, is war. Peace is an exception.
That's right. A period of absolute peace is practically unheard of, and periods of reasonable relative peace, if you go through history, are rare. I should make it very clear. I'm talking about most of human history, periods when there's a system of multiple states. There are periods when there's not so much war, when you have one whole region of the world under a single ruler, then there's obviously relatively little war.
The Pax Romana was maintained by fighting barbarians on the fringes
on the frontier.
All the time.
But that, you know, that's not like, sure, but that's not what we normally mean by war.
Yeah.
Rome got to be that by winning wars against other states. But then for a while they were so powerful they didn't have to fight those wars very much. China surely had periods when the emperor was able to just beat off barbarians on the frontiers. But when you're talking about a system of multiple states, such as has been characteristic of Europe and most of the world since the Middle Ages, then it's very, very rare to have any long stretch. This is just not an opinion. You simply have to look at the facts and register that fact. That is so. What is worth arguing is it likely to continue to be so when you have multiple states?
Well, then you come to the argument advanced by many over the last 50 years, maybe with a certain amount of deep naivete, but still with a kind of hopefulness and a humane concern. Many who've argued, in essence, yes, states are the key to the problem.
Right.
States are intrinsically selfish, and they may be, in fact, guided, as Thucydides said they were, by fear and by the prudent concern that somebody else might be gaining on you and preparing to attack you, as well as by honor and interest. And therefore, we must go beyond the nation state. We must create, essentially, a government of
sure.
all mankind.
Well, the first serious thinker that I know of who said that was Immanuel Kant.
Mm-hmm.
And he went and wrote for a while, saying that has to be the answer for the very reasons we've given. And then he thought some more, and he said, wait a minute, that cure will be worse than the disease, because he concluded that if that means a monopoly of power in the hands of somebody, and that person, those people are bound to be tyrants, and that would be the end of all human freedom. I fear that that's the way it is.
I could live with all of that. Everybody could live with all of that if you have any kind of any commitment to being realistic and being honest about how life is really structured. But for the further concern, which has been voiced for so many years, and that was voiced constantly through the period of the Cold War, namely that the methodologies of destruction are now so
sure.
potent that we might not be able to survive,
sure.
the world might not be able to survive, a major war between major powers.
That wins from me the following agreement. It's more important than ever to do everything possible to avoid or stop war. But that doesn't mean we should stop using our brains when we analyze why wars happen. They don't. There's no way to stop them that anybody has ever thought of, which is sort of the friendly way of let's all be nice to each other in one manner or another.
Then you are beginning to suggest, and I know that this is something that you've argued and in many op-ed pieces you've written and other things you've written apart from your major books, and your arguments have been very influential in this regard. I think what you're now approaching is your argument that you got to fight some lesser wars to preserve the peace.
Yeah.
You got to protect yourself from those who would use power if they develop it irresponsibly and
sure.
with the
sure.
no concern for the total future
sure.
of the human race.
I mean, if I may quote from an earlier book of mine, because there are two ideas that I think are very simple but are people don't generally think about them at all, much less think they're right. First statement is, a peace does not keep itself. There is this incredible sense that if you just don't do anything bad, there won't be any wars.
Peace is not just the absence of war.
That's right. Peace, the maintenance of peace is a rare event in human history, and when it happens, I observe always that the following things are necessary for it to happen. Here's my second favorite personal cliche, which is the greatest possibility of peace is when those states who are most interested in preserving the peace also have the predominance of power and the willingness to use it.
That brings us, right after some impending commercials, down to the modern, down to the present moment,
sure.
Or the moment as it was a few months ago,
yeah.
As we readied ourselves for an invasion of Iraq, and we've since carried that through. But there we are in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and who knows where else we may have to go. Many argue this is the Pax Americana, and it's just as distasteful as the Pax Romana.
Right.
I think you would argue, well, the Pax Romana worked rather well for a long time.
I'd also argue this is not the Pax Romana.
Let's talk about all of that. Let's zero in on the present situation faced by American policymakers in the world. We return to Donald Kagan directly after these words. And directly back to Donald Kagan, I think I brought you to the point where we can now, I hope you will now directly address the Bush administration and its view of how we are located in the world, what threats face us, what our interests require, and does honor still have something to do with it?
Well, let me take the last piece of that. It seems to me honor is a very critical part of understanding what's going on in the world. I remember that right after 9/11, all sorts of academics and intellectuals made pretty much the same statement explaining what had happened, apart from the fact that it was all the United States' fault. But the essence of it was that it was the poverty, the lack of development, those sorts of things out there in the Muslim world that were the explanation. That was pretty quickly blown away by people simply pointing out that most of the perpetrators were not poor, that they were educated, that they were middle class and better, and all of that stuff. But then any better analyses that have come down the road since then, it's important to realize what they amount to. They really amount to a sense that many a Muslim feels dishonored by the course of history. They point legitimately to the great days of Muslim leadership in the world, not merely their power, which was enormous in their extent, but also their lead in all of civilized activities, scholarship, the arts, all kinds of things. There was a time we were the best, the greatest, and the number one. Now we're treated with contempt in the modern world. I really think that unless you understand that, you just don't know what's going on. And why they feel the way they do towards the United States and states like us, and why they act they do, reflects the fact that they recognize we have supplanted them. Our culture is in place of theirs, and they see it as an insult to them. And nothing short of the destruction of us and our way of life, leave aside the religious question of our being, you know, Christians and Jews, but rather the whole culture is that insult. So it's a much more serious and deeply rooted problem. Can't be brushed away by UNESCO.
But that mentality is held by whom? Surely not by all the Arab states.
No, by the militants who
are behind.
By the
terrorists.
By the terrorists, yes. But, you know, and those who are support them.
But if they get their hands on some serious weapons, they can do a great deal with those motivations.
Absolutely. And
as we saw on 9/11.
And they don't even have to get their hands on the usual weapons of mass destruction. I mean, you get some ordinary airplanes and use them as bombs. No, they are a very, very great menace, and that we have to understand. And it's not a menace that will be done away with by changing our policy here, there, or the other place. That's important.
The significant innovation in stated foreign military policy by the Bush regime, and only after 9/11, to declare that we reserve the right to wage preemptive war.
That came, I think, after 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course,
preemptive is scotch the snake before it bites.
Of course. It's worth pointing out, I mean, as a historian, there's nothing new in the world about preemptive war.
To be sure.
People have always fought preemptive wars when they thought it was necessary. We, the United States, for instance, has, to my knowledge, I don't think we've ever fought a preemptive war. And the reason for that was we were also fat and stupid as not to believe that anybody was going to cause us any harm. We were protected by these two oceans. So we were kind of like the Romans were for a stretch of time. We'd wait till they beat us up, and then we'd get ourselves our act together and whip them. So, but that's out now.
It is out, and we need to examine it more fully. The policy that now guides this administration extended into the world in some crucial ways. and for that matter, the question of what ought to be undertaken from here on. And I look to you for a response on that. We pause for just a minute or so for a quick update on the news, and then directly back, but now to the newsroom and Judy Pilak. Don Kagan, you come from Yale University, as I think you remember. And I was a kid assistant professor at Yale University many years ago. And I know of Yale University that virtually all of its faculty opposed, as I suppose was true of the faculties of most of the major universities in this country, opposed the Iraq war, except you, maybe one or two other colleagues.
Yeah, I think there are about two or three others.
Two or three others out of a faculty of...
About 600.
Of 600. So there's deep opposition based upon really the notion that we should not be undertaking any kind of preemptive activity.
Yeah, that's right. But not only preemptive, that was retaliatory. They were against us doing that.
You
have to understand how...
We should turn the other cheek, perhaps.
We should, whatever it was, we shouldn't do anything to the people who did that stuff. That was the general idea. Because largely it was our fault anyway. And most of what's wrong in the world is our fault, too.
Our fault by virtue of?
By virtue of doing everything wrong.
Having been colonialists.
Yes, if you
or
like.
Or friends of the colonialists.
Or that, or just being capitalist, or just being prosperous, or just being not being part of a revolutionary movement of some kind or other. All of that. There's a form of madness that is so hard to understand and is so far divorced from what normal human beings in America think.
Well, if it's hard to understand, make a bit of an effort, would you? Because I find it very hard to understand, too. These feelings are found in various sectors of the American population, but nowhere with as much intensity and with as much near unanimity as among the academics.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're not going to get a good answer from me because, I've tried all my life to understand it, but I'll do what I can. Part of it is simply historical and sociological. Most of the tenured faculty at universities these days grew up in the 1960s. They were students in the 1960s, and they were totally infused with the ideology that was rampant at that time. And it was an ideology that was particularly potent because most of them were avoiding the draft. And what I think is not widely understood is there was a powerful motive in what people felt and thought. Nobody wanted to go to fight in Vietnam. In order to justify that act that would have previously been thought an act of irresponsibility, bad citizenship, even cowardice, had to be justified. To justify it, you had to say the war was wrong. To justify that, you had to say America was wrong. To justify that, you had to say America was bad. If you didn't believe those things, you were a very bad fellow. These poor folks have been dealing with that guilt ever since.
And these are, in Roger Kimball's phrase, the tenured radicals.
Tenured radicals. And they mostly run the university now, and they hire people like them.
Sure.
And so there are very few. I always like to ask students at Yale, can you tell me all the teachers you know who have a view different from what is the overwhelmingly dominant view on the faculty today? These days, I come up with no more than four.
You remember Julian Benda's book of a long time ago, The Treason of the Clerks.
Yes.
By the clerks, he means the intellectuals.
Right.
Do we face a trahison des clercs here
sure.
as well?
Sure. Now, that's been going on for a long time. That treason, intellectuals in the West, and increasingly in America, used to be mainly Europe, but increasingly America...
That was written by French intellectuals.
I know. Had to do with this sort of absolute falling for one form or another of anti-democratic, totalitarian regime. Many of these guys at one stage were falling to the right at the right time. They were going fascist. You know, guys like George Bernard Shaw at the right time thought Mussolini was a hell of a guy. But then, after a while, it became exclusively to the left. And to this very day, these folks don't seem to remember that Stalin did what he did.
Our policy in the world should be what?
Our policy in the world, number one, American interest, which also squares, I think, with our ideals, is to establish and preserve conditions of decency and peace in the world in which we have to live. And that I hope that sounds as though I'm speaking in the active voice. There's no way for that to happen if we don't actively attempt to create and maintain that. Well, that sometimes means, as you were suggesting earlier, that you need to fight people who are trying to destroy a decent and peaceful world. Else the whole situation will collapse. It's best, my favorite, I've coined my own cliche so I can enjoy them properly. And one of them is, if I had my way, my foreign policy would be this. You know, you see this in America, lots of places where it says, don't even think of parking here. And my foreign policy would be to create a world in which you'd be able to say to anybody, don't even think of using force as a way of settling whatever grievance you have.
Of using force against us or using force, period?
Period. I mean, I would want a world in which the states that were trying to preserve what I want to preserve was so powerful and so understood to be responsible that it would be futile and insane to try to change things by force. That's the way, that's my best shot at preserving permanent, perpetual peace. It wouldn't be permanent, perpetual, but that's the best shot.
But we can't get that from our erstwhile allies and friends, can we?
Not just now.
Not from all of them.
Not just now. And that means, and it has always meant, these things are never done by universal consent. It's always somebody takes the lead, and if he that state is capable of it, brings along others who really have the same interests, or largely the same interests. And that's what our best hope is now. And we need to be critical of our own behavior. Sometimes it's wrong-headed, sometimes mistaken, but also we have to be skillful at doing what we do. We really need to win friendships. That's important.
Well, how, all that said, do you now evaluate the undertaking regarding Iraq?
Oh, it was inevitable, it was necessary, and it really had...
What made it necessary?
Well, I was going to say, it really had little to do with 9/11. The fact of the matter is, it was necessary to remove the regime of Saddam Hussein because of what he did in 1991, when he invaded Kuwait and really tore up the rules of the game and said, you can do this kind of thing and survive. It was a terrible mistake to let him survive, but it had to be completed. The message had to be, if you do that, you're gone. So I would say before 9/11, there was every reason for doing
it. It would have been much better, I'm sure you agree, if we had marched to Baghdad.
Terrible blunder.
In the first Gulf War.
A gross strategic misunderstanding of such a level, I can hardly believe it. Yes. But once 9/11 took place, you would have to be deliberately deaf, dumb, and blind not to see that Saddam Hussein, whatever the proofs of this detail or that detail, was a part of the general movement that was involved in this notion of attacking the United States, destroying its weakness, destroying its power, and so on. So it was all the more important to do it, whether or not he had 12 weapons of mass destruction or 3 or whatever.
Yeah, right now there's a big brouhaha. There's an awful lot of fuss about how we have not turned up the weapons of mass destruction which prove the case or verify the reasons that we ostensibly gave for going in there. In fact, Blair in England is facing a virtual revolt from the Labour Party on this right now.
Yeah, I think it would be nice to point out that those people who are making that criticism, let us assume for a moment that there are no weapons of mass destruction, or were none. I find that inconceivable for a whole lot of reasons, but let's say that's so. Now let's compare that with the reasons that people gave why we should not go into Iraq and what was going to happen if we did. Every one of those predictions was incorrect, so their opposition to our attack on
Iraq. Which predictions do you have in mind?
Well, first of all, they were going to use weapons of mass destruction that they didn't have, you may remember. And second of all, they were going to fight like tigers, and it was going to be a war that would last for months and mean endless casualties. And I'm just warming up. Not one of those horrific predictions came true. They were never sincere. And nobody, by the way, nobody doubted that Saddam had those weapons. If you look at what Chirac and others were saying at the time, they never doubted that they had them. They just said, we should go look for them before we go and fight. So that's a very unpersuasive complaint.
We reach a point where I should speak of another Kagan. Your son, Robert Kagan, who was on this program perhaps about 2 months ago, has done a slender but very influential and very forcefully stated book, which talks about the difference between the American orientation to the inimical, threatening world out there and the European orientation.
Yes, but you can sum it up in the most easily memorable phrase that he uses, which is that Americans are from Mars and Europeans are from Venus. And behind that is his belief that Americans still live in the world that I describe, a world in which power, politics, and the kinds of concerns I have mentioned continue to be significant and therefore need to be met from time to time by force if civilization is to be preserved. He believes that the Europeans have talked themselves conveniently into a different belief that, in fact, the world can be ruled by law without the use of force, and that it would be a much better and gentler and kindlier world if that were so. And he points out that there's a good reason for each side to hold the view that it does. The United States is an enormously powerful state. It therefore finds it conceivable that when something dangerous comes on the scene, one can defeat it with power. Europe has made itself an enormously weak body of states, and therefore every thought of using force against any danger is terrifying. So it's best to believe that it's also unnecessary. I think that's more or less what he said.
I had an interesting encounter yesterday, as I was telling you, with the computer screen. I was down here in the afternoon doing some work and thinking about our thing tonight. I entered your name on the search engine and found a video representation, real video, whatever they call it, of an important teach-in, I guess they called it, at Yale University some few months ago, in which you
before
are...
Before the war.
Yeah. Four Yale professors, you're one, two on one side, two on another. So that you found at least one other Yale professor
absolutely.
Who stood with you. But then, later in the evening, I was poking around and I brought up, as I sometimes do, the Newsnight from BBC, which is a very interesting program where they do some serious talk about what's going on in the world. And there was Tony Blair quoting your son and saying he disagreed. He thought that Europe wasn't so pusillanimous, it wasn't so given to looking away, and and of course that's in justification of what he himself committed himself to in the Iraq War. And then lo and behold, shortly after that, they bring up your son, speaking from Brussels, where he's with the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and your son said he hoped that Blair was right, but he feared that he probably wasn't, with regard to Europe.
That's right, and he thinks that Tony Blair is a great hero and deserves enormous praise for the very difficult job that he did in keeping Britain solid with the United States, which made it much easier for Bush to operate. And so, and I share that. I think we have to do as much as we can for Blair, just as a sense of honor.
A man for whom neither you nor I have much regard, but who all the same is a significant historical figure in our time, was, that is in the last century, was Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, who in one famous article asks, and indeed he borrows it from an earlier Russian, I forget just which one, but the basic simple question, he must have raised it often, is, quote, what is to be done? When we return from some commercials, I repeat the Lenin question to you. What is to be done from here on? We return directly after this. The book by Donald Kagan that we were drawing from in our earlier conversation, which really hangs in the air in everything we're talking about tonight, is the Peloponnesian War. And it is just published by Viking. And let's return to Thucydides. I just asked you, how would you answer Lenin's question? What is to be done? What would you and Thucydides say about what is to be done right now?
Well, Thucydides would be very hard to say, because he really, I think he had a very dark view of things at the time that he wrote his book about the war. Things had gone wrong from his point of view in just about every way. His view of Athenian democracy was that democracy, true democracy, democracy where people did what they wanted, was a disaster. They would do stupid things like he thought they did in the war. You needed to have a leader of extraordinary quality like Pericles, and Pericles was gone. But not only that, the country, Athens had gone past him. They didn't have leaders like that anymore. So I think he would have pretty much despair. I think, let me back up. He would have said, I think you need to have a change of regime in Athens, and you have to bring in a more oligarchic regime where men of better wisdom and character would run the state.
It's interesting. That's what Plato essentially says.
Yeah, he was moving in that direction. Yeah. I think a lot of folks...
Plato may have learned that in a sense from Thucydides or from the general...
And the Peloponnesian War was seen to have discredited Athenian democracy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, we don't have the same problem in America, I think, but in a way, there is. It's a place to start, because I think the American people are, in my judgment, very poorly educated these days about the realities of international relations and about the realities of government and about the realities of political life at every level, either uneducated or miseducated. Every state that's ever existed, in order simply to survive, has required that the values of that state, of that society, be passed on to the next generation, so that why it was necessary to support and permit that state to flourish was a significant and important thing. I'm not sure we're getting that message across. And secondly, of course, people had to be realistic about what individual people were like and what societies were like and what the world was like. All of that seems to be missing in American education. So I'm very concerned that the step number one...
Can we pursue intelligent desirable national policy with a miseducated American public?
Well, I think the answer is, in part, yes, if we wait until something terrible happens. I think we could not have done anything like what we should have done until 9/11. But that 9/11 revealed the nonsense that people were hearing from their culture, and the average human American is not perverse in this respect, and I understood that's wrong. And when a leader came forward, in the former President Bush, who said, here's what it is, here's what we need to do, and here's what we're going to do, they all said, you're right. So that, but it's better in the world that gets more dangerous every day, not to wait for a disaster before that happens,
sure.
And that's where the problem is.
Well, right now, something's going on with regard to Iran, we know. And there is the question of North Korea looming there as well, and Syria for that matter.
Sure.
What are those, you have contacts with some of those guys, what are they up to?
Which guys?
The guys in the Pentagon and the State Department and the White House.
Well, my connection with them never gets me to the point where I know what they're thinking about these things. They're much too discreet. I don't get it. But I'm prepared to tell you what I would tell them.
Yeah.
And whether they listen or not. And I think first thing to start with is, in spite of what everybody seems to think, the United States is not as strong, simply even militarily, as we need to be to cope with all the problems that confront us. For instance, we have been operating for at least 10 years on the myth that we are capable of fighting two serious regional wars at the same time, but it's blatant that we aren't. Our entire policy about Korea demonstrates the fact that we are absolutely afraid of having any military action there. It's not a question of deciding whether it's a good idea or bad. We just can't do it. So first thing we have to do is we got to get stronger than we are, much as that will cause dismay in many quarters. That being said, in the dealing with the cards that we have, it's necessary for us to be clever and also determined in coping in ways short of war with places like Korea. And I would say with Iran, I'd be reluctant to act against Iran just now, partly because of the limits that we have before us, but also because Iran seems to me to be a country that's more complicated than a lot of these places. There's clearly tremendous opposition in Iran, I can't tell you how tremendous, but serious, to the government. I would not like to compromise any shot that they might have to bring about a change, especially since it's very difficult for us to act.
I suspect that we're in there right now. We do have a CIA.
Oh, sure.
It has been revived,
sure.
And I would suspect that we're in there helping to foment a revolution.
I would hope so, but I mean, you can't tell it's going to come out. On the other hand, it seems to me to be inappropriately difficult to decide if we should want to do that, that we could say to a state like Syria, there is no question, there's no doubt, nobody for the longest time could have a question about it, that Syria is a major supporter of terrorist groups that are easily identified and has been since at least the 1970s.
Well, both Iran and Syria have essentially set up and continue to fund and sustain Hezbollah.
Right, and more than that, there's a couple of others in there. So my point is, there's no reason why we can't use the language that Rumsfeld was using. He was sounding off and being very tough with words anyway, saying, we expect you to stop that now, and here's what we want you to do. And I say, when they don't, because I think they won't, we should be prepared to take military action to take those people out, if we're serious about this.
That's strongly said.
Yes.
Tell them to stop supporting any terrorist activities at all.
And we know where they are. They're in the Bekaa Valley. We want you to dismantle those camps.
And if they don't, and you predict that they won't, then take military action.
Right.
That would mean military action against those
Syria.
Two, against Syria particularly.
Well, in Syria.
Not Iran.
Not Iran. Because, you know, Iran is certainly engaged, but that's a different story. You got to treat them all differently. Syria, there's no reason in the world not to do that, and we should. And what's more, I mean, people will say that many of our allies will be against that. That's certainly true. But then that raises a certain question. Are they our allies if they're not interested in putting an end to known centers of terrorist activity? Then they're not our friends.
Is there any likelihood that we will do this?
No, No, because politically it's so difficult, politically, internally, and externally. But I think it would be the right thing to do. And I think, you see, it would be more than even that, in my judgment. If you removed Saddam's regime, and then in a fairly short time, you put this ultimatum to Assad, and if he didn't come up with that, you did another one. The message that we need to have in the world would become more and more serious, which is, it's very dangerous for you to harbor terrorists and enemies of the United States. Why any American shouldn't think that's a good situation to bring about, I don't understand.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
I know you're not.
But I know that some might well say, well, look here, though, you can't go on arousing the Islamic world by invading and knocking over more or less legitimate regimes.
That strikes me.
You're just going to create still more enmity and ultimately more terrorism.
That strikes me as a statement that could only come from somebody who simply hasn't observed what's been going on in the world. The greatest hostility to the United States is expressed in various ways. In those periods when we are not taking any action against Islam, every time we do take action against an Islamic country, but which is doing things that are very nasty, the prediction is made that the entire Islamic world will rise up against us. In every case, the consequence has been a reduction in the amount of activity by Islamic states against us. That's what happened in the first Gulf War. That is what's happening now. The situation is less dangerous than it was before. So I think that's just a total misreading of reality.
In this context, we haven't even mentioned it. I haven't yet raised it. But where do you place the continued Israeli PLO standoff? Negotiations have just resumed again. The president will be with them tomorrow, literally. That is, with the two prime ministers.
Yes. Well, it would be a good thing in itself if a way could be found to bring peace to Palestine, because it is troubling in itself, and it also spreads other trouble. However, it's a great mistake to think that that is central to the problem we're dealing with. That is peripheral to what we're dealing with. I think the problem with Israel and the Palestinians will go on until they are able to resolve it themselves, whatever is happening in the terrorist world. And the terrorist problem will not go away if either tomorrow one side or the other is destroyed, or if they make peace. That's just not the way it is. Those are two separate issues. They touch upon one another. They influence one another. But those people who focus on, we've got to solve the Palestinian question before anything can happen, are simply using it as an alibi for not taking action in the other case.
We reached the point where some commercials are more or less due, and it's time also to invite telephone calls. We've just opened the lines. The number, as ever, is 591-7200. 591-7200 for any question or comment you'd like to offer in response to the conversation so far. Our guest, Donald Kagan, a professor of classics and history at Yale University, is the author of the very important new book, The Peloponnesian War. Allow me to say, just quickly, because I haven't yet, quite apart from your dealing with important stuff and doing it very intelligently and full of interesting interpretations, you write very well.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, this
much.
Is a very readable thing.
Thank you.
Frankly, it's more readable than Thucydides.
Well, it better be. He's hard to read.
591-7200, the lines are open. If you want to reach us via email, the email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word, @tribune.com. And that's a recommended strategy for anyone who's listening on the Internet at some great distance. And if you're listening in the Middle East, having just awakened, and want to give us a call, rather give us an email, we'd be delighted to hear from you. We will return and directly onto your contributions after these words. And we go directly to the phones, the number 591-7200. For questions and or comments to Donald Kagan, author of The Peloponnesian War. And you are first on the air. Good evening.
Hello. Professor Kagan, I'd like to ask you what your views are on how Machiavelli would have approached the world scene of today. I think in some ways the Renaissance Italian situation is similar on a small scale to what we see in the world today, in international relations. Do you see any similarities there?
Well, Machiavelli is hard for me to talk about because I always see two Machiavellis, the one who wrote The Prince and the one who wrote the Ricordi. One of them is a great champion of Republican life, and the other is an advisor to princes who remind me of Saddam Hussein. So
right.
It's hard to know which one. I like to think that the real Machiavelli was the Republican Machiavelli, and he would have given, I think, hard-headed, realistic advice about what is necessary for a state, particularly a state that he admired, a Republican state that had virtue, what it needs to do to survive and flourish in the world, and that is to discover, resist, and defeat evil.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Yes, he said that you should always prepare for war, even in peacetime, and that you should constantly train for war, and that you should, it's more important to be feared rather than loved.
That's right.
And that's what we're not doing in the world today. We're trying to be loved too much, I think.
Well, it is certainly true that we are not nearly so feared as you would think we might be, given how people describe us as such a fearsome power. But it turns out they have no hesitation in spitting in our eye. I don't know how to put those two pieces together.
Right.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have heard from you.
Good night.
Let me give you a. Let me read to you an email. I have thought President Bush could have, quote, adapted Pericles' funeral oration for his first public speech to the American people after the September 11th attacks. I believe that the power, feelings, and sentiments were similar. What are your opinions? It's worth, for a moment, talking again about Tacitus and his semi-invented speeches.
Yes, well, there's a great debate among scholars as to whether the speeches reported in Thucydides were actually given, and if they are accurately reported by Thucydides. I'll just give you briefly my conclusion. My conclusion is that he never reports a speech that was not really given, and that he's always trying his best to reproduce what was said, but his capacity to do so varied very much. So some of the time, he's just doing a certain amount of guessing as to what was said. That being said, I think the funeral oration is not really the speech that would have been appropriate for Bush at that time. The purpose of the funeral oration, I take to be to explain to the Athenians, maybe you're right, yes, you probably are right, to explain to the Athenians why it was right for them to be risking their lives for Athens. And his answer was because of the very special character of what Athens was and what it was to be an Athenian citizen. I've often thought that speech resembles very much Lincoln's Gettysburg Address.
It's a panegyric to democracy.
It's a panegyric to democracy and a whole way of life which is more than democracy. Yeah. But yes, it includes democracy. And it includes, incidentally, people tend not to emphasize this, it includes the importance of greatness, by which he meant very often military greatness, not merely the great cultural greatness, which was Athenian as well. I think you're right. That would have been a good thing to be thinking about.
One thing that really surprised me a bit in your treatment, in your version of the Peloponnesian War, people reflecting on Thucydides see two, what's most often quoted are, well, three things. First, that those introductory comments, which I asked you to read. Second, some portion of his description of the Sicilian campaign. And third, the Melian Dialogue.
Yes.
Could you only give about a page or two to the Melian Dialogue and to the whole situation concerning that island?
Yeah, well, you do have to make some judgments when you're trying to get it down to a reasonable length. But the reason I don't go...
That's where the Athenians sound most Machiavellian.
Well, yes, I think that's right. Where the Athenians certainly are the most brutal and give the most hard-headed, inhuman almost, reasons for a terrible action they are going to take. And it is Thucydides, I think, very carefully not only reported it, but placed it right next to the Sicilian expedition, because the Athenians are saying, you got to be hard-headed, you got to be tough, you mustn't be sentimental, you mustn't be carried away by your emotions, and then, of course, they go to Sicily and get themselves into a disaster for those reasons.
But we should explain to those who don't know quite what happened on the island of Melos, what this is.
Well, what happened was the Athenians tried to get the Melians to come into their empire. The Melians refused. The Athenians said, if you don't, we're going to kill all of you sell your women and children into slavery. And the Melians resisted, and the Athenians did
just
that.
That's what they did.
Yeah.
So they weren't exactly pussycats.
The Athenians were tough, mean imperialists.
Yeah.
And people who say the Americans have an empire need to take a look at a real empire. The Athenians imposed their will on their allies by force, and when they misbehaved, they killed them. We don't do things like that.
We go back to the phones now, 591-7200. Good evening, you're on the air.
How are you?
Fine, sir.
Sir, I could not disagree with you more. I think the American, certain members of the executive branch do just that. And my comment is that the FBI and media collude to rape the public of its legal and civil rights And so my question is, isn't that a form of war?
No, it isn't a form of war, and I don't even think it's a fact.
I think you're living in la-la land, and I think your definition of war should include vagrancy. War generally is ethnocentric pathology on the part of a person or people, aside from other things, and that there have been cases that I know of where the FBI and the media collude to poke fun at individuals who are victimized by those agencies and whose relatives end up dead as a result of those agencies. I think you are a disgrace, sir.
I can only bow to your superior knowledge.
But we do usually require a certain amount of manners from our callers, and I think I recognize this fellow. He's been in once or twice before, got through our screener, and we bid him a fond farewell. 591-7200 is the number, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberger.
Yes,
excellent
sir.
Show once again. Mr. Kagan, I have a question for you. I was wondering, given that you feel that our military is not capable of responding to two major conflicts at the same time, I'm curious to see what your opinion is of reinstating the draft, and if you do think it should be reinstated, what period of time would you suggest it be reinstated for in order to provide a cohesive military unit?
No, I don't think it would be good to reinstate the draft. I think our armed forces are at the extraordinarily high level that they are now because they are a volunteer professional army. I wouldn't change that. It's been a great, great success. What we need to do, however, is to simply get some more. I don't think we're an enormous distance from where we need to be. In other words, I don't think we have to revolutionize our defense program in order to get where we need to be. We just have to spend a little bit more money and make some more of an effort to expand our forces. That's all.
So you would suggest maybe raising the base level pay and the benefits to...
That's true, but I think beyond that, it would just be that we would undertake to recruit more people as we need them, which we could do, I believe.
I tend to disagree with you only because having served in the military and having two teenagers at home myself, and having tried to talk them into, you know, at least looking at it as a viable option, it seems like there's a large portion of the younger generation of America that doesn't seem to feel the necessity that we as older, maybe wiser people who that have more of a worldview understand where the threat's coming from and what's going to, you know, need to be done to respond to it.
Maybe I could cheer you up a little bit by telling you just anecdotally. Now, I was totally surprised this year by how many young people at Yale expressed to me an interest in having a military career. Such a thing would have been inconceivable some years ago. So things might just be changing a bit.
Sir, we thank you for the call. I fear we must move on because we've got a last batch of commercials to process instantly. And then back to the phones and to the email. There are now a few lines available. If you've been trying to reach us on the phone, try again. 591-7200. 591-7200 for email. The address is extension 720, one word, at tribune.com. And quickly back to the phones. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi. When I was 4 years old, my mother started reading the Iliad to me in Greek. And so I got hooked early. And as I was growing up, I'd eat up every new translation that came out. But then I realized, how can there be so many from one original source, say? So I want to ask, I have the Hobbes translation, University of Michigan, 1959. Did the author today come across any new type of source that may have come to light in the last 60 years or so?
You mean translations of Thucydides?
Yes, sir.
There are several newer translations. There's one that's not brand new, but it's very popular.
Let me guess, Rex Warner.
Yeah, Rex Warner in the Penguin.
That's quite readable, I think.
It's very readable. It's the most readable. My favorite translation is by a 19th century Englishman by the name of Crawley. It can be read. It's not so remote, and I think it's closest to the spirit of what Thucydides said.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my favorite. But if you want one that is the easiest read, and it's perfectly fine, I think Rex Warner and the Penguin is very good.
We thank you, sir, and quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, this is Rick. I just read a book on the CIA by Robert Baer. He was a career field officer and supervisor in the CIA. He recruited agents in the Mideast, And the book was called See No Evil. Could paraphrase it, the closing of the eyes of the CIA, wherein they have turned to satellites and listening to the satellite communication, or, spy planes and all that kind of thing. Remote intelligence versus on-the-ground intelligence. Is it possible to comment on the possibility that our CIA has, in fact, lost its teeth?
Well, you'd have to know much more about it than I do. The CIA has had its troubles, of course, from the beginning. Military intelligence and political intelligence are among the most difficult aspects of international relations and war. Hardly anybody ever has a good enough operation along these lines. I really don't know enough to have a strong opinion. I have a non-strong opinion, which is that we do know that in the 70s and in the 80s, there was a real attack on the CIA. It was thought to be some kind of evil. They kind of ripped it down. And what the situation you described is an accurate description. And that's foolish, since in living in this world requires knowing as much as one possibly can about everything that's going on. And remote devices are not adequate at all.
I agree. Maybe one more question?
Go ahead, sir.
How far could we go in recouping our losses from the Iraqi oil that we now have control of?
I would be surprised if we could do very much. I think it's a very important part of the outcome in Iraq, from our point of view, is to establish a stable regime in Iraq. And they will need a lot of money to make that work. So I think only in that sense would that help. It means money we don't have to give to rebuild Iraq. Let their own oil rebuild them. That would be part of it. And the other is, look, our government rightly says in the face of unjustified criticism, we're not there to profit from Iraqi oil. We are not imperially engaged in there. We are trying to help the Iraqi people have a decent form of government. That being so, we got to let them have their own oil money.
Mm-hmm. I would feel more encouraged if I saw more progress going on in Afghanistan, where we made the same promises.
Except there's no oil problem there. However, we have, in my judgment, we've made mistakes in both countries in terms of inadequate preparation for the post-war activity. We've got to correct them in both places.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Bye.
And quickly to another, 591-7200. Again, some lines available if you've been trying to reach us to make another quick attempt. You are on the air. Good evening.
Thank you, Dr. Rosenberg. I tuned in late, but I'd be curious of your guest's opinion of whether or not the timing will ever come to institute a universal service where we can budget literally as people are born by the time they reach some predetermined age of 18 or so, where they literally commit 2 years of their life like many countries in the world require people to do as citizens.
I don't know if we ever will, but I'm not sure I would want it to happen. Maybe I'm just unrealistic, but this is a free country, and I would prefer, whenever possible, consistent with the country's needs, if we would have people undertake whatever duties we think they need to have voluntarily. I feel it would be more effective, but it would also suit the spirit of our country better.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Another email. What effect did the war have on Athenian democracy? Didn't the defeat of Athens lead to the trial of Socrates? And second part, and this one is very inviting, and could you discuss the remarkable character Alcibiades?
There's the knight's work right there. But as to the first, there's no question that the war, and particularly the losing of the war, and I might add to, this is relevant too, the emergence in the course of the late stages of the war of an anti-democratic faction that actually produced a coup d'etat that overthrew the democracy, and then at the end of the war, the establishment of an oligarchic, quasi, I would say, fascist regime that also threw out the democracy. That caused a great deal of bitterness among Athenian Democrats and a great deal of anger against those people who had been hostile to the democracy, of whom Socrates was a very famous one. He was a notorious and open critic of so much of what happened democratic. There was a great prejudice against him, and I have no doubt it played a large role in his fate. And what was the second question?
Alcibiades. You describe him as the man who betrayed three different nations in this conflict.
That's right. He was a phenomenon that really was not known publicly. If there was anybody like him before, nobody knew it. And the great thing about him was how modern he was, how un-Greek. the Greeks were typically so attached to their native city-state, and that some of the most important parts of their lives and personality had to do as a function of their service to their state. He seems to have broken clear of all of that and made himself and his ego and his achievements and whatever, his fame, his goal. He didn't care where or how he did it. And he astonished his contemporaries, who were amazed and admired him enormously.
He was, in the jargon, a charismatic character.
He was charismatic.
He had tremendous public following for a while.
Beyond belief. And Aristophanes, in one of his plays, has this marvelous line about Alcibiades, the Athenian attitude towards Alcibiades. They love him, they hate him, they cannot do without him.
Does it remind you of possibly a recent head of government in the Western world?
There are one or two similarities, I would think. But it seemed to me that Alcibiades actually did a lot of stuff. The American analog didn't do very much.
Yeah, I guess not. Alcibiades was one of the leaders of the Sicilian expedition, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was his idea. And the amazing thing was, because of politics, he got himself thrown off the command of that and actually pursued and forced to flee, having to do with his political enemies. So he never got to really run that show.
Is that when he goes over to Sparta? Or
he goes to Sparta, yeah, when he is being pursued by the Athenian courts.
And works for them for a while.
Works for the Spartans, does okay. Then he proceeds to, it is believed that he impregnated the wife of the king of Sparta. And so he found it useful to be elsewhere. So he showed up at the court of the Persian satrap in Asia.
He sounds like the very model of a modern political sociopath.
The man had great future in modern politics.
But, you know, that brings us to an interesting question, which I always like to burden historians with, and that is sort of the accident of personality and the way in which history hinges on and is sent in new directions by particular aberrant or larger-than-life characters.
Yeah, well, there's no question that I agree with that entirely. And Thucydides, one of his greatnesses was, this is very rare, at the same time as he was in a way a pioneer, I would say he was a pioneer of the concept that there are forces in history that are impersonal and that need to be taken account of here to understand what's going to happen. I think he really pioneered that. And at the same time, he believed that individuals had the most decisive importance in what happened in history. Both things he could keep in his head at the same time, and I think that's both of them are true.
So you could play the counterfactual game with the Peloponnesian War, or with Greece before the Peloponnesian War, and if you alter one or two presences, that might lead to a world without the war.
Absolutely. I mean, it's entirely possible. I would put it this way. I don't think the Athenians could have taken the course they did that ultimately helped bring about a war unless Pericles was determined to do it. Pericles had so much influence in Athens in those days. It really was his policy, and it was a hard policy. And even he had a fight like the devil to get that policy and to hold to it. Anybody else wouldn't have been able to do it.
A world without the Peloponnesian War would have been different in every other particular from there on, I suppose.
Yeah, or even a world in which the Athenians had won rather than lost.
Yeah.
Because Athens was like nothing else that the Greek world saw, and it had the possibility, I don't know of any certainty, but the possibility of creating a new, dynamic, powerful state, democratic at home, imperial abroad, with the capacity to expand that only a naval state could do. It might have produced an empire of a size and of a different character than the world had ever seen, for good or for ill.
The empire that followed immediately thereupon was the Macedonian Empire.
That's right.
Alexander the Great.
That's right. And that was really ephemeral. It did last for a couple hundred years in the successors to Alexander, but it really didn't have anything to hold it together. Athens was different.
It had no theme.
Athens was very different. I'm not saying it would have been a good thing, I don't know, but it would have been very different.
But if Athens had been there as a continuing power,
oh, yes,
that would have affected...
There would have been no Macedonian conquest.
And would there have been a Roman
And they're empire? Very possibly not. Now you're into the iffy game beyond even my capacity to guess. I love to play counterfactual history. That's the only history worth doing.
Most historians object to it.
Well, they just don't think. There's no way to do history without doing counterfactual history. What do I mean by that? If you simply say, as a historian must, this course of action was wise, that means that course of action was unwise. So you would have to say, what if they had taken the unwise course in order to know that was wise? There is only two kinds of history, no history at all or counterfactual history.
There's also the question of whether history can, in fact, be objective and can be totally reliable. Von Ranke's famous advice that the task of the historian is to tell everything the way it really happened.
That's right.
Can we know, alles?
No.
The eigentliche Wesen?
No, of course not. But the mistake is at the other end, is the cynical approach that Shaw has one of his characters in one of his plays say. Somebody says, but what will history say? And the character responds, it will lie, as usual. But no, the truth is in between. Of course one cannot know exactly the truth or every bit of the truth or anything. On the other hand, what Ranke really meant, and what I think every historian worth his salt has to believe, is that following the correct procedures as honestly as one can, subjecting oneself to criticism so that one cannot escape by making easy mistakes, that's what you got to do.
Speaking of counterfactuals, in the space of 1 minute, which is all we have left, I fear, let's do counter futures rather than, or whatever, I'm not quite sure what to call this, but what are the hinges upon which our future will hang from here on?
I think the most important single one is the capacity of the America's leaders, the current one and the ones in the future, to understand what's necessary and to have the capacity themselves to do what great leaders do, to educate the American people as to what is important and what is necessary so that they will be willing to bear the burdens of what the world is going to have in store for us.
Donald, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been an exceptional pleasure for me to have you here. And we'll be talking to you a good deal on the phone as the world continues and as American policy continues to develop.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Donald Kagan's new book is The Peloponnesian War. It is just published by Viking. And I have already said once, and I hereby reassert, it is eminently readable and indeed an excellent literary experience, as well as basic introduction to very important aspects of Western history, history that applies or from which one can draw lessons that do apply to the present time. And with that, we'll come to the end. Time is just about out. We'll be with you with some taped features the next two nights after ball games, and we'll return on Thursday for a program about Jelly Roll Morton with Howard Reich of the Tribune, who's done a book on Jelly Roll Morton, and we'll have a good deal of music as well. That to follow. For now, time only to say goodnight, and thanks to all for listening.